What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello from Tokyo. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have a really great interview for you with Matt Corallo. But first, I have a message from my show sponsors. If you're interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender, servicing customers worldwide, including 47 states, and their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. And what about my other lead sponsor, Paxful? They've been sponsoring the podcast for a while now. Have you checked them out yet? Just give yourself a couple of minutes. If you head over to their website, you can find out why they are a proper Bitcoin company, offering the most comprehensive options for buying Bitcoin that I have ever seen. They accept bank transfers, debit and credit cards, PayPal, Western Union, but they offer over 300 payment options for buying Bitcoin, all listed on their website, so make sure you go and check it out. Also, they are a true peer-to-peer Bitcoin marketplace. They have a full-service escrow system, and they offer 24/7 customer support. These guys are awesome. Check them out at paxful.com, which is paxful.com. Okay, so on to my interview with Matt. And firstly, if I sound tired, it's because I am. I'm over in Tokyo. I've got an interview with Mark Karpalis in the morning as part of my Mt. Gox series, but I've been up for about 24 hours. I'm absolutely shattered. It's midnight here. I haven't slept. So if I sound tired, I'm really sorry. But anyway, on to my interview with Matt. And following my interview with Brian Bishop, I want to ensure that I keep encouraging developers onto the podcast because there's so much to learn from them. And I've spoken to Matt a couple of times, but we hadn't managed to make something happen. I randomly bumped into him in San Francisco, offered to rebrand the podcast Blue, and with Matt heading to London for a conference, he agreed to come on, and I'm really grateful to him because this really was a fantastic interview. Matt was clearly jet-lagged, but gave me an hour of his time for a really great interview discussing what makes Bitcoin work and other important topics such as Lightning, UX, and fungibility. If you have any questions about the interview, you know, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I look forward to reading any questions you may have. And also, listen, if you want to support the show, there's a section on my website that explains everything you can do. And listen, if you want to support the show, there's a section on my website which explains everything you can do. Just head over to whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support section. And I do need to thank my Patreon top-tier sponsors. Firstly, make sure you check out vidyen.com, WordPress plugins for advertising, and Monero mining reward sites. That is vidyen.com. And check out honeyminer.com, who make mining and earning money simple for anyone with a computer. Okay, I hope you enjoy the interview with Matt. As I said, if you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Morning. Pretty good. Finally got some sleep, caught up. Okay. A little bit jet lag, but that's all right.
When did you get in?
2 days ago. I've had a few nights, but...
So we nearly flew back at the same time then. Well, it's back for me.
Almost, yeah. Yeah, I think we must have.
Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it. You're a vegan.
Yeah. I remember
that.
Yeah, unlike most Bitcoiners. We do have a vegan contingent. I'm not the only one, but we do have a veg contingent.
How long have you been vegan?
3-4 years. 4 years maybe. Right. And was veg for a bit before that, so.
How do you find it?
I don't know. I like it. It's easy. I mean, I live in New York, right?
Okay.
It's ton of great veg food in New York. It's a little bit easier than a lot of other places, so.
So I did just over a year, and I broke with Jameson Lop. Interestingly enough, so I did it with my mum. She was sick and did it, and went out to North Carolina, recorded with Jameson, went to shot guns, and then he took me for barbecue, and I didn't have the heart to tell him that I was a vegan. So I ended up breaking then and haven't gone back.
I mean, breaking for North Carolina barbecue is not too bad. North Carolina has pretty great barbecue. I'm sure I'll piss some people off with that, but that's okay.
These boots are vegan. Back from the day.
There you go.
Are you full vegan, like clothes, everything?
Not really. Mostly just food.
All right. Okay. Right. So let me give you the very quick background. My podcast tends to try and bridge the gap between not so technical and the technical people like yourself, people like me who want to learn more about it but have no idea. So some of the questions might be the more simpler ones you get asked, but hopefully
sounds
it helps.
Good.
Yeah, I think we should all learn a bit more. What would be good for me, though, is not knowing you very well. I only met you for the first time about a week ago in San Francisco. Would be for you to tell me, just give me the background, because from where I am, you seem to be one of the leading, most prominent core developers, yet you seem very young. So I want to know the background. Is it just a youthful vegan face or...
No. I think we do a pretty good job, I think, generally in the Bitcoin space, especially in the developer community, of not kind of considering people's age. We consider experience. I've been working on Bitcoin Core since early 2011. So I got involved around a similar time as Greg Maxwell and Peter Wulla and Vladimir Vanderlaan. So I got involved at a similar time as a bunch of people, and we all kind of worked on it together and kind of learned about Bitcoin and experienced the space together. We just don't discriminate based on age, I guess. More about experience and all these things.
What drew you into it? What was the discovery moment?
So I got involved after I watched a podcast, actually, that I watched regularly, that did a deep dive, like hour-long technical deep dive into how Bitcoin works, which was fascinating to me. I mean, I was in high school, I was a little bit bored, I was a geek, and I saw just like all of this really cool, the incentive structures around how the system fits together, and I thought this was really awesome. I thought this was really fascinating, and I just kind of went down a rabbit hole and started contributing and started trying to see where I could be helpful, and yeah, went down a rabbit hole.
And now you're based at Chaincode Labs?
Yeah, so now I'm at Chaincode Labs. We're a research lab in New York. We generally, our mission is help Bitcoin where we can. We don't make a profit. We're not interested in making a profit, really. And we contribute a lot to Bitcoin Core. I have done a little bit less of that over the last year, comes and goes. But we have a number of different projects, from OpTech to the residencies, to some of my projects, to still a bunch of Bitcoin Core contributions and a number of other things.
Great. Okay. So there's a couple of questions I always like to start most interviews with, just to... One's more out of interest, one's more to get an understanding of the person I'm talking to. So I saw a very long time ago, I was listening to an Epicenter interview with Adam Back, and they asked him, what is Bitcoin? And his answer just really blew me. So I started asking this to everyone in my interviews, and I always get a really different answer, but I think it's great. So Matt, what is Bitcoin?
Wow. Okay. So... Yeah, I mean, I think Bitcoin is, to me, a lot of it is the culmination of around 30 years of attempts at building eCash and this kind of digital money for the internet. People have been trying since the 80s and 90s. There was a whole eCash revolution. There was a huge bubble in it. A bunch of people tried to build things. None of it worked out. And Bitcoin is the first shot, is a kind of a renewed effort. And I think the best shot we've had so far at really building that. Right. And I think that's fascinating. And I'm really hoping we can get it there. We'll see what happens.
What does get it there mean, though? Because like a lot of people say it's still an experiment, or it's, you know, it's essentially still like a beta. When do you think we get to the point where we go, oh, you know, it works? Because I'm kind of there now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's complicated, right? Bitcoin works for a lot of use cases today, works very well for a lot of use cases today. Obviously, user experience is terrible. I think mining centralization is a really big question. It's interesting to me because things like Lightning, things like better pool protocols are ideas we had in 2012, 2011, 2013, 2010, people wanted to build like payment channel networks, all these things, and we're only just now kind of finally getting a chance to actually work on these things and really build them. And So from that point of view, it's like kind of, I don't want to say that we know whether Bitcoin kind of works until we've really built the things we knew we needed to build in 2011, in 2012, and then we'll kind of see where mining centralization is, where user experience is, where kind of how trustless can we make the average user experience while still having it be usable, all these really big open questions that we just can't know yet.
So that's really interesting as well, the way you talk about all the other things you wanted to build over the years, and you're finally getting the chance to do it. Because a lot of times where people ask me what Bitcoin is, I'm like, it's money or digital gold. But actually, I've started to see it more like a financial network, like a financial infrastructure, almost like a financial internet. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, I really like that analogy. I really like this kind of... We're building infrastructure around this thing, and this thing can create, you know, Bitcoin isn't just the blockchain Bitcoin. It isn't just the miners. It's also Lightning. It's also sidechains. It's also all of these different exchanges that people build on top, all of these businesses. That is all cryptocurrency, and that is all Bitcoin. And yeah, I mean, you have to analogize it to infrastructure. You can't just say like, yeah, well, Bitcoin is just this thing, right?
So the other question I like to ask people, just so I understand them as well, what projects do you have an interest in within crypto outside of Bitcoin, or are you just pure Bitcoin?
I mean, I have a lot of interest in some of the kind of cryptographic research stuff. I really like the CT, CA, that kind of vein. So that's Mimblewimble, that's Monero, that's kind of in that vein. I think that stuff's fascinating. Not that I'm a crypto expert, I wish I were, but I still think it's fascinating. The infrastructure analogy I think is interesting because I view, you know, I have interest kind of only in building the best we can build. And I think I think Bitcoin is still the best bet there because we have so much experience and so much precedent for how changes get made and how the system works and how people interact with it, that it's really kind of solidified a little bit, I think, what properties it will have in the future. Whereas everything else, while the research is cool and like kind of from a tech perspective, it's cool, the actual social aspect and the aspects of like what it is and how it will exist in 5 years and 10 years are completely unknown, whereas with Bitcoin, we have a little bit of visibility into that. And so I just kind of am more drawn to how can we take that and build the best Bitcoin we can have.
Right. So do you have like zero interest in, say, Ethereum?
I wouldn't say zero interest. I mean, I view Ethereum as totally orthogonal, right? The kind of Bitcoin build financial infrastructure stuff is a very different concept from Ethereum. We're still in research phase. We're like changing the inflation schedule based on, you know, some developers deciding these things without much community interaction. Like, I just don't think that's a related system. You know, Ethereum, the vision of build all these kind of dApp, whatever, it's just different. Yeah. I wouldn't say that they're really in competition. I am less interested in that. That's true. But I also don't necessarily think it's like inherently bad. It's just not related.
Okay, almost. That's cool. Okay, so as I said, I've tried to, you know, it's been over 2 years now. I've been like fully embedded in learning about Bitcoin and crypto, and I've gone through all the kind of altcoins and come back, and I'm pretty much focused on Bitcoin these days. And I've tried to understand the technical stuff as best as I can. Did a great interview with Brian Bishop, who explained to me the onboarding of new developers. And actually, one interesting thing I asked him if he remembered his first commit. Do you remember yours?
I don't. I kept thinking for a long time. I thought it was this UPnP work so that Bitcoin Core can automatically, or at the time wasn't even called Bitcoin Core, it was just called Bitcoin, can automatically map ports on your router. But someone told me, I think like a year and a half ago, that it was actually just some minor bug fix, and I almost don't have the heart to look it up to figure it out.
Well, that's your Genesis commit, right? It's kind of important. Yeah. Right, so I bought Master in Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and I was like, huh? and I've listened and watched videos, and I'm getting better. But I think it'd be useful, as I said, there's lots of people who are like me, aren't very technical. Like, how does Bitcoin work? If you had to compartmentalize it into its key components, all the different things, like, so in my head, I'm thinking you have a blockchain, you have a mempool, you have miners, like, you've got all these different components that make Bitcoin work. But can you, like, explain it from your side? What are the key infrastructure components of
Bitcoin? Yeah. I mean, so obviously, like, I view Bitcoin as more than just the chain, more than just Bitcoin Core. So it includes everything, in my view, right? So we have Bitcoin Core, which is this fully validating node. It actually it's responsible for forming consensus, and it's kind of a base layer that everyone uses. And then we have the exchanges who use that and then use their own wallets and have their own way of interacting, have their own business logic with their own way of interacting with the chain. Then we have miners, which includes pool servers and all the way down to ASIC firmware and ASICs themselves. That's a key component of how Bitcoin works. And we have, well, I guess that's kind of where the mempool comes in, right? You have the mempool of transactions, which is essentially primarily for miners so that they can actually construct blocks and do the work of including transactions. We have Lightning, obviously, now is becoming very popular. That's also a key component. Of course, you also can go down the Liquid and RSK route, talk about sidechains and some of these systems people are building on top. So I think, yeah, I mean, I view Bitcoin very broadly. Like, Bitcoin isn't just Bitcoin Core, and you don't just contribute to Bitcoin by working on Bitcoin Core. Sure, it's a critical part of infrastructure of the whole network as a whole, and everyone uses it, but everything else matters too, and people building good wallets and people building all of these other things maybe matters more, because ultimately that's what users interact with and that's how they view Bitcoin.
The Bitcoin Core itself isn't like one central brain, right? That's the node software, right? That
Bitcoin Core, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Bitcoin Core is just a software project. It is responsible for consensus, right? So it's responsible for everyone looking at the blockchain, downloading the blockchain, agreeing on what the current state of the blockchain is. So just globally, everyone has to, ultimately, it's a consensus system, and ultimately everyone has to agree on what the current state of blocks and the current state of transactions that are included in those blocks is. And so Bitcoin Core is kind of responsible. Bitcoin Core, the software, is responsible for doing that for each of its users.
There are different versions of the core software, though. Different nodes can be running different versions, right?
Sure.
Because the first time I heard about that was with the CVE bug. It only affected certain versions of the software, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, speaking of that, am I right in thinking you put your hand up and tried to take responsibility for that?
Yeah. Technically, the patch that introduced the bug was mine. We generally, in the Bitcoin Core project, we generally blame people who reviewed patches instead of people who wrote the patch, but ultimately the blame falls on everyone involved, right? So ultimately, everyone should have seen it, no one caught it, you know, I shouldn't have written it, everyone else should have caught it when they were reviewing it, but yeah.
Was that a real, like, oh, shit?
Yeah, that's maybe an understatement.
But as, you know, based on what you've just said, then really you should have just come out and blamed all the people who reviewed the patch.
Yeah, but it's you know, it's a community, right? And ultimately, everyone, more people should have reviewed it. Those who did review it should have caught it. I should have caught it. There's a lot of people at fault.
Software has bugs, right?
Yeah,
and
software has bugs.
I discussed this with Brian, and he said, look, there are known bugs right now within the software, and there are unknown bugs, and this is going to keep happening. Like, how much do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a big concern, I think. For the first few years of me working on Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin software, I think our biggest concern by far was just what happens if we have a bug that you know, everyone loses their keys and all of a sudden the whole thing is falling apart and like there's nothing that can be salvaged from the system. And how do we think about building software that is this kind of reliable? There are some things we can take inspiration from. So some of the like life critical safety software, things in medical devices, things in airplanes, that kind of software. But ultimately, that's still not quite comparable because their solution generally is run everything three times on three different implementations and three different CPUs and three different systems, and you just pick whichever one gets repeated, right? So you have the different systems vote on what the solution is. That doesn't really make sense in a Bitcoin or blockchain system because ultimately all you've done is changed from we have this one implementation that's fast and whatever to we have to run three of them. And now if there's a bug in two of them or if there's they somehow disagree, ultimately our consensus is just defined by all three instead of just one. So it doesn't really solve the problem, at least in this space. So it is actually somewhat of a unique engineering challenge, just how do we build this kind of high assurance software for this particular type of financial application. There's not great parallels, and so it's been a little bit of a science or attempt at building a science around it to figure out how this works in a way that like just we have to invent it.
Right. So is this something that's actively being discussed quite a bit within key development groups?
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely something that people focused on for a long time and spent a lot of time thinking about.
Right. One of the things Brian also mentioned, he said, if you were going to build Bitcoin today, you wouldn't build it as it currently is. He said, as it currently is, it's like it's one like big, huge, messy code base. You would want to, I can't remember what he said, like it would, but he was almost like compartmentalized sections of it.
Yeah, the original Bitcoin software was very monolithic. It was very, like, all of the code is in one file. The wallet stuff that is per user interacts heavily with the validation code and the consensus code. It's gotten a lot better. We've cleaned it up a lot. The separation between different parts of Bitcoin Core has improved drastically over the years. There's still a ways to go, you know, nothing is perfect, and there's still a lot of kind of cleanups and compartmentalization that people want to do, and that will, you know, continue to slowly happen. But if we were going to start over today, things would be a little bit cleaner, but ultimately we've learned a lot, and we have improved the software so much over the years that, yeah.
And how do you feel about when people are talking about wanting to kind of calcify the base chain? Do you think that's ever realistic?
I don't know. I think that's an open question of how changes get made to the system in 10, 15 years. You know, how things work today is fine and great, and we have a lot of things we want to do, but there's really big open questions still around minor incentivization and fees and these kinds of things that, you know, I don't think we're not there yet.
Right.
But, you know, maybe we'll get there and it'd be cool if we did, but I don't know.
Right. Well, we'll talk about mining next. One more question. My experience with developers is they don't really care about price, which I think is great. But does the price and therefore the value of the network change the pressure?
I don't think it necessarily changes the pressure too much. I mean, there's no question I like it when the price goes down. but it's less because there's less pressure and more because the scams go away, right? Bear market means it's harder to raise money. And so as a result, you get fewer just completely nonsense ICOs and nonsense whatever. And that's nice, right? Because too much of, hi, I'm a blockchain developer, just gets interpreted as, hi, I'm a scammer and I do like technical nonsense that doesn't really make sense and, take a bunch of money from the public for it. So it is actually kind of nice sometimes when the price goes down.
It's funny. Now we've been in it for like essentially a year now, this bear market. I've got to that point where I'm now enjoying it. You know, the first 6 months, it was my first time. I thought it was horrendous.
Yeah.
Like losing all my money. But now I've kind of come to terms with that. I'm actually enjoying it. I don't check. I haven't even seen the price today. I don't think I've checked the price for a couple of days. I actually started to enjoy it. So that's kind of cool. Okay. So let's talk about mining then, because I saw a presentation of yours once where you talked about BetaHash.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know much about it, but I do know it's to do with mining centralization. Is it GPU mining?
No. So BetaHash is about changing the way pools work.
Okay.
So the key distinction is kind of today in Bitcoin mining, and in fact in virtually all cryptocurrency mining, the pool does the kind of important work. Right, so the pool selects the transactions, they run full nodes, they validate blocks, they validate transactions, and they tell the miners what to mine on. They tell them which transactions to include, what the previous block is, all of that good stuff. They also are responsible for collecting the rewards, splitting it out, and reducing the payout variance, which is kind of the key point that all their users care about. These two things are not really tied together. So BetaHash is about splitting it out, allowing the users, the actual mining farms, the people who own the ASICs to select their own transactions, validate the blocks themselves, run their own full nodes, but still allowing the pools to exist, allowing the users to pay the pool, pay into a pot, and still get that reward splitting and variance reduction that makes their business work, makes their payout stream consistent enough that they actually can pay their bills at the end of the month without compromising centralization as a result.
Right. Okay. So I'm a miner, but when I say a miner, I've got 70 S9s and I think 70 Dragon Mints, and I've sent them somewhere and I pay my fees each month, which is less than I'm actually mining. Sorry, more than I'm actually mining at the moment. But like I do that and I'm barely involved. And any thoughts of having to assemble a block or do it, it goes above my head. But I think what I'm taking from this is that what you want to do here is you want to give the benefit of being part of a pool without the person operating or the company operating the pool having too much control over the blockchain.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And, you know, obviously I think most people will not run their own full node. Most people don't want to do it. Like just aren't going to put in the effort, but giving users the option and making it really easy to, you know, keep using the same pool and just switch over if they have a lot of hash rate, if they're worried about decisions that are happening either in the pool or just generally in the network and want to, you know, help decentralize and help, you know, keep Bitcoin secure and censorship resistant and all that good stuff, they can just get a little full node, get a little Raspberry Pi, whatever, run their own node, point their hash power at it, still keep their payouts just the same, and help decentralize Bitcoin, and just like give everyone the option to do this. Because today, if you want to do that, you have to solo mine, and then you get one block every 5 years, and you have to pay power every month in spite of that. So,
So what is the risk with miner centralization? I mean, I've heard of things like mining like orphan blocks or empty blocks. I don't know. This is way above my head. But what is the risk of miner centralization? What abuse of power do they have?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key, kind of trust model in Bitcoin is ultimately that hash power is decentralized enough that no one takes kind of full control over it. And so there's a number of related risks. There's a number of kind of risks within this. So the most obvious one is just transaction censorship, right? Especially as people start thinking about Lightning and any kind of proof of work secured sidechains, this idea that some group of miners might either be forced to or might decide to or might, because of a technical bug or whatever, not include certain transactions could result in people losing money. Or could, of course, result in like fungibility issues, making accepting Bitcoin much more complicated because all of a sudden you have to check to make sure your counterparty isn't some terrorist or isn't on some blacklist, something like that, right? Another important issue is right now, the protocols used to actually mine are very vulnerable. They're completely unauthenticated. They're not secure in any way. They're not intended to be. And it would be rather easy for someone to hijack a large percentage of Bitcoin hash power for some medium to short period of time and use that to, you know, they could mine empty blocks, driving fees up or something like that. They could also reorg out blocks. They could undo transactions and double spend, these kinds of attacks. So these are, you know, much more serious attacks resulting in transactions that you thought were confirmed, not confirming, you know, makes people wait a lot longer for confirmations, these kinds of things. But those attacks are also possible. And certainly when you have more mining centralization and more centralized control, it just makes the system much more brittle.
Okay, so what is the status of BetaHash? What has been the, how receptive have people been? What's the rollout status? How's it all going?
Yeah, BetaHash, it's, so BetaHash doesn't result in anyone getting paid more. Mm-hmm. So that makes it a little bit trickier to convince people to do a whole lot of work to integrate it and support it and switch to using it.
Does it require the mining pool to use?
Yeah, so
right.
So it requires mining pools to restructure their code to support a whole new protocol, essentially potentially run a completely parallel infrastructure, so they have to essentially run two mining pools. They've got, you know, existing mining pools have done a ton of work on optimizing their infrastructure and making sure everything is really well tuned, and now I'm showing up and asking them to run a completely parallel infrastructure for no additional money.
And less control.
Less control. I think, you know, there are a number of pools who don't, I think in fact maybe most pools don't really care about the control. And some pools, you know, like the Slush Pool folks and Poolin and some of these guys, you know, they don't want that control. They'd love to see something like BetaHash exist. But of course, there are practical challenges in terms of actually getting customers who want to do this, and so there's questions about customer demand, and of course just the technical reality of having to run this thing is steep, and so there's a steep cost. And so, you know, seeing that kind of customer demand would go a long way to convincing folks to want to spend all of the time to build this. But of course it's also just going to be slow, right? Because engineering takes a while, and so getting that kind of adoption, it's just, you know, it's going to take people a while.
What if it was a new pool? Is it just a simple, is it simpler for a new pool to set up with this?
Yeah, so the structure of the implementation I have now is supports building a new pool that also supports Stratum and also supports all the existing protocols that people want to use. And so you're like completely backward compatible and you could have kind of a single infrastructure. And so there is definitely an angle of new pool might be a little bit easier to convince to use this or convince to support it.
And are there any new pools that have established using it?
Not yet. I mean, it's not exactly a common thing for new pools to show up, right? Because you need, you have to have enough hash power ultimately to actually have reliable payouts and reduce the variance effectively. So, you know, new pools don't spring up overnight all the time. But yeah, I mean, I am talking to some folks. Hopefully we'll get there. We'll see.
Okay. Next up, I talk to Matt more about Bitcoin tech, including Lightning Network. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsor. So, something a little bit different for BlockFi today. I'm heading out to New York to see these guys pretty soon. Well, I'm hoping to. If I can make it work, I'm going to hop on a plane because I've got a bunch of things I want to talk to them about, because hopefully we've got some really cool announcements coming up soon. But in preparation for that, I'd love to hear from anyone who's become a customer of BlockFi because of the podcast ads. Please reach out to me. Drop me an email on hello@whatbitcoindid.com because I'd like to have a talk to you. Can't tell you what it's about, but it's something kind of cool. So yeah, please do feel free to reach out to me. But if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender servicing customers worldwide, including 47 states, and their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. That is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. Back to Bitcoin. Another thing I wanted to ask you about was fungibility. So over time, I've been speaking to different people and gradually getting a picture of fungibility. And it seems like most people want it in some way or another. But there's kind of different opinions. Some people want it on the base chain. Some people want it as side chains. Some people are kind of saying to me, well, you get a fungibility with Lightning Network. I've also heard people saying, look, you don't want fungibility because if there was, say, something like an inflation bug and you couldn't detect it, you might miss the creation of coins. Mm. I'm very at the limit of my technical ability. Yeah, but so where are you?
Let's split fungibility out into kind of a few different subcategories, right? Okay. So fungibility at a kind of pure definitional sense just means that every Bitcoin is equal to every other Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So you could rather realistically argue today that we have fungibility, that Bitcoin is fungible. If I pay you one Bitcoin, you're going to value it at exactly one Bitcoin, same as any other Bitcoin you receive. You don't necessarily go analyze which Bitcoin and value it at some discount or something like that. And obviously, we need that, right? Like if you had a merchant and Bitcoin weren't fungible at whatever layer they were using, and someone tries to pay them, they have to like do some risk analysis and like and try to figure out whether that's really a good Bitcoin or a bad Bitcoin, and like maybe charge you more or less. Like that's just nonsense. We can't have that, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when people talk about fungibility, obviously you kind of very quickly go down the privacy rabbit hole, mm-hmm. because the easiest way to make sure that your currency is fungible is to make it completely private, right? If there's no information that you can assign to a given coin, right? If no coin is technically any different and it's completely impossible to identify a difference between coins, obviously they are fungible because there is no technical way to differentiate them. So, you know, people talk about different ways to achieve fungibility. And so when you referenced the idea that if you have some of these things and there is an inflation bug, maybe you won't be able to identify where the inflation bug occurred. That's properties of very specific privacy systems, right? So that's a property you have in Zcash and these kinds of CT systems where values aren't public and you don't have that kind of ability to analyze the chain and look at the history. That isn't necessarily true in something like Lightning, where you have this privacy property where hopefully as Lightning matures and as we fix bugs in it, etc., we can say that when you receive a Lightning payment, you don't know anything about where it came from. You don't know anything aside from, yes, I received X coins, which has this kind of fungibility preserving privacy property, but doesn't have this potential risk for inflation and whatever, or undetectable inflation. So it's all a question of, you know, where does the privacy come about and how do we make sure that Bitcoin remains fungible as we go forward? There are a lot of threats to fungibility, and I think, you know, obviously it's pretty key. Luckily, so far we've been mostly okay on fungibility, So
can the Lightning Network act almost like some kind of mixer, in that I can deposit a Bitcoin in? Say I'm a drug dealer, all right, and I'm getting paid in Bitcoin, and the police are aware that I've got my cocaine dealing Bitcoins. Can I put them into the Lightning Network, send them to another Lightning address, and they'll come out the other end, and nobody will have any idea where they've come from?
Potentially.
Wow.
There's more complicated element. You know, Lightning is still pretty early, especially in some of the privacy analysis. There's a lot of great ideas and a lot of intuition around where we can get the privacy of Lightning, and there's a lot that's already implemented, and there's a lot of things that we know we can do, but it's just not done yet, essentially, right? There's different types of attacks that we're aware of and we have ideas of how to solve, but just haven't gotten that far yet. It's new, it's fresh. And so, you know, potentially Lightning could be used as a mixer in the future. Maybe. We don't know yet.
Okay. But there's no blockchain that can be analyzed within Lightning, right?
Yeah. So there's no kind of direct history. You can't just go download the chain and look at it. But there are more active attacks, right? So when you consider privacy, you have to consider the full system. And if someone is actively monitoring the entire Lightning network, maybe they can remember certain things that happened and could build their own history, right? And this, the same is true for a lot of other systems in the space, right? You look at Mimblewimble and systems like this, and it's like, okay, yeah, well, there's privacy on the chain itself, but if you're actively monitoring the network at the time of the transaction, you might have actually still been able to learn something. And so some active attackers, maybe you don't actually have as much privacy against them. And so that's kind of where the attacks come in Lightning, is we have, there are some active attacks that we know people can do. There are probably some unknown active attacks that people can do that just because of bugs in the software or whatever. And we're spending time thinking about, you know, how do we make sure we can prevent all of these? How do we have a more robust privacy model?
Okay. So, because I'm assuming chain analysis, you know, they've done a lot of work analyzing the blockchain. You know, they've raised, what, a couple of hundred million now? I can't decide whether that is awful or good. I think it's mainly awful. But I assume they are going to be looking at Lightning as well because it's relevant to their work.
I assume so, yeah.
So it sounds to me what you're saying is, I heard Laura Shin describe Zcash is like a Sudoku puzzle. You get bits of information and you can start puzzling together the rest. Mm-hmm. Is that almost like what's happening with Lightning Network then?
Not quite.
Okay.
Lightning, yeah, I you look at Zcash and there's, because the privacy is optional and because it's still, they don't have kind of, to my knowledge, any kind of peer-to-peer network level privacy. There's still a lot of kind of bits that you can piece together, and especially because in essence no one really uses the privacy because it's opt-in, at least today, it's very easy to piece together a very large majority of what's happening. Now, in Lightning, the kind of privacy, or at least the routing stuff, is baked in. Everything is, there's none of this global consensus. So you have to be way more active in terms of building out exactly a full map of the network and being aware of the current state of everything. So it's not actually necessarily clear that you can get enough information to really be, to really de-anonymize a lot of payments. We're still working on it, I guess.
Right. So let's talk a bit more about Lightning. So actually, interestingly, I've only used Lightning Network for my first time 2 days ago, in that I was waiting for my Casa node, which, by the way, I got a delivery notice coming today, which is exciting. Nice. But I set up a Blue Wallet.
Mm-hmm.
And so my instant experience of that was like, that was way too complicated. I had no idea what was going on when I first set it up. A choice of language and the usability, right? And it made me think about when I first spoke to you, said, you know, what are the things you like to talk about? And one of the things you said is actually user adoption. You said, you know, there's work needed to be done on user adoption. So just before we start, are you in the HODL camp, or are you in the, you know, we should be creating a network that people should be spending and using to spend? Because the way I look at it is that if you want to onboard people, people usually come for, if you get beyond like the geeky interest, it's usually for financial returns. That's probably one of the best ways to get people onto the network. I can't see us convincing people to say to them, unless they've got some private transaction, to say, well, we've got this cool new way of buying stuff from Amazon. First, you go to an exchange, you buy some Bitcoin, then you transfer that onto a Lightning wallet, and then you go and pay. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
I think
I think we
can only onboard people onto using Lightning as a way of making payments if they're already in Bitcoin and they've already got kind of Bitcoin wallets linked to a Lightning wallet.
Yeah, I mean, so I obviously agree. Like, no one's going to switch completely to Bitcoin and Lightning just because they want to pay their coffee. Like, their cash, their credit card, whatever, it works fine. You know, there's a lot of other privacy properties that we'd like, and maybe we can get some users from that, and that's great, and we should be trying. But ultimately, you know, I think I view kind of adoption of Bitcoin as people will adopt it when they need it, right? And so there are people who are interested in financial returns and interested in digital gold and whatever, and that's great, and I fully support that, and I want those users as much as I want users in Venezuela and users in China who have capital controls and need to work around that and need to send money home and these kinds of things where financial services aren't providing that feature. As much as I want Bitcoin adoption in marijuana, legal marijuana in the US, where banks are largely not serving these communities and they have lack of financial services. You know, Bitcoin is an alternative. Bitcoin, there is an existing system, and the existing system works great for 99% of people in the Western world, and maybe 99% of payments, but the existing system works fine for most people. If it didn't, then there would be some new existing system. Bitcoin fills the gaps, because there are ultimately a lot of gaps in the existing system for various reasons, and some of that is in the Western world, a lot of it is not in the Western world, and, you know, I build Bitcoin for mostly not me, because the existing system works just fine for me, but, you know, Bitcoin is all about where can we fill a gap.
Okay, so how do you feel about kind of user experience? And I'll tell you what my experience was in Blue Wallet. So I transferred, I think, 0.05 of a Bitcoin in, and only because somebody told me I needed that for liquidity. I had no realization that I needed that. And then I waited for my 5 confirmations, but I didn't know it was 5 confirmations because it didn't say. So I just sat there looking. And then I had to transfer into the Lightning wallet, but the use of language was things like refill, and there was and then it talked about, and I couldn't transfer my whole 0. I tried to transfer my whole 0.05 and it wouldn't let me. He said I didn't have enough funds, because obviously I have to account for the mining fees. For me, I used to be a UX designer, so for me, using that, I just found it really complicated.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a lack of UX designers in the space? Do you think we're just a bit relaxed about it? I mean, how do you feel? Because I feel like we celebrate the Lightning Network there, but I'm almost scared of being critical. But I wanted to go, well, this was kind of bullshit.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm totally right there with you. You know, obviously Lightning is still super early, but frankly, so is all of the UX in most of the space. Most cryptocurrency user experience is generally really terrible. I actually saw someone recently had a different take on it, which I thought was really cool. It was like, yeah, cryptocurrency user experience is terrible, but the fact that there is any adoption in spite of the absolutely miserable user experience is like amazing, and we should be excited about that, and that should show us that, like, if we fix the user experience and we improve this stuff, maybe we can like really get some awesome usage out of this stuff. Because I think, you know, there's obviously a lot of value to be had here, and there's a lot of problems that cryptocurrency can solve, but we have to get the user experience there.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lightning is early. I've been working on a project for the last about year that hopefully takes a lot of the burden off someone who wants to build a new Lightning wallet or wants to build new things around Lightning, and enables people to, you know, developers to really focus on the user experience, really focus on building a good application instead of spending a year building Lightning protocol details and making sure they get every possible edge case of on-chain handling correct. So I'm really hoping that can help people you know, focus in the right place and do their job well, because I mean, I'm not a user experience person. I don't know anything about UI design, whatever, but hopefully I can help provide tools so that people who are good at that can run with Lightning, can run with Bitcoin, and hopefully build something that's hell of a lot more usable than what we have today.
So I've got a theory. I used to have a web agency years ago now. Developers are terrible at user experience, and I think the reason why is all the developers I've ever worked with are some of the smartest people I've ever met, and a lot of the experience of using systems comes very naturally to them. And I always said to them, we need a UX designer because we need to build the systems that people who can't code and can't figure out need to be able to use. And it feels like within there's like all this has been built by like all amazing voluntary developers. It just doesn't feel like there's been like an incentive structure to bring UX designers in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, another problem we have generally in cryptocurrency is there's not a lot of money to be had building wallets. There's money to be had building exchanges. There's money to be had, you know, building a few businesses in the space, but building a wallet, especially a decentralized wallet, or one where users hold their keys, like where the real meat of the UX challenges are and where we really want users, you can maybe fund 1-2 people full time if you're really lucky, and we need more resources there. And it's not necessarily clear how to get more resources there, because no one wants to pay to use their wallet, or even if they do, there's not necessarily enough users in the space yet to pay a ton of full-time people with very small microtransactions for people who want to use Bitcoin. Yeah. So it is definitely a challenge.
So what is the status of Lightning? You know, again, like Bitcoin, it's in beta now. But what's the status like?
Yeah, if that. I mean, it is still super early.
Okay.
And as you point out, you know, a lot of the UX, you know, some of the UX challenges are because of the way the protocol is today. There was a Lightning Developer Protocol Summit in Adelaide late last year, where a lot of discussion was around what small tweaks can we make to make Lightning way more usable. So simple things like getting inbound capacity, right? When you install a Lightning wallet, you have to first send payments before you can receive payments. That makes no sense, right? That's like, how are you possibly going to use Lightning? So, you know, getting inbound capacity, getting these kind of relatively simple things that make a huge UX difference into the protocol. And so that's still ongoing work. That's still something that a lot of these systems haven't been built yet, or at least none of them have been shipped yet. And so that's still early. A lot of this, you know, Lightning is in beta in the sense that you can use it. People kind of are playing around with it a lot, and it's really exciting how many people are excited about it and playing around with it and starting to use it, and it's really cool. But it is still so early that, you know, it just UX, it'll get there, but it needs another years.
Well, the scary thing is lost funds, though, and all the things I'm seeing of people using Lightning Network, I haven't seen actually an instance of somebody going, my payment disappeared. I mean, maybe it's happened.
Yeah, I mean, that's a testament to the incredibly intelligent people working on it, right? From the Blockstream folks working on C-Lightning with Rusty and Christian, and those folks, brilliant guys, to the L&D folks, you know, Connor and Lalu, and all those folks are also brilliant. The Eclair folks, also really smart. You know, that's really a testament to just how smart some of the people who are working on it is. And that's kind of where, yeah, Lightning's in beta in the sense that it's usable. You're probably not going to lose funds. Like, there's good software around it. It's an alpha in terms of usability, and the protocol still needs a few more revs and, like, all these things.
Tell me about the routing thing, because it's something that I've read about a bunch of times, and like, it's a computer science thing that's never been solved and blah, blah, blah.
I'm so confused about that. Like, literally, in my, like, the second course that I had to take for my computer science, like, bachelor's degree, right, was about algorithms. And the very first thing we learned was routing algorithms. Like, routing is not hard from a computer science perspective. Routing is super solved computer science problem. Now, routing and lightning is not necessarily that simple. Because routing and lightning, you want to consider a lot more things about node reliability, right? If you just want routing around how do I minimize fees, super easy. Like, how do I get the very lowest possible fee? Okay, this is not that hard. If you want to route around, well, how do I weight these different considerations? How do I consider, well, that node charges very low fee, but it's not online very often, so if I try to route through it, it might get stuck, or it might, like, might have to try again somewhere else. You know, how do you balance these different considerations? That's actually a challenge, and that's just it's a practical engineering challenge. It's not really, like, a computer science theory question. And I think it's very solvable. Like, don't get me wrong, I don't really consider this to be a major issue, but it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of gaining experience too. It's going to take a lot of seeing how people use Lightning and seeing how the network evolves and incorporating that into thinking about how do we build good routing heuristics for ensuring you have consistently low fees and consistent user experience and making sure you don't get stuck payments and you just get, you know, really fast payments all the time.
So it's just FUD, really.
It's just FUD. And, you know, things are early and there are problems with stuck payments today. There are problems with routing like that. That exists.
Stuck payments.
Yeah. So there is occasionally you can have a case where if a node goes offline in the middle of your payment, you're not going to be able to necessarily clear the payment or consider it to have failed for a few blocks or until some intermediate node goes onto the chain and gets transactions confirmed, which really sucks. I mean, right, the whole point of Lightning is you get fast payments, and if you get a stuck payment, you're like, well, now I'm waiting for that node to go on chain. That hurts.
But that's hence why, you know, Lightning now, you should only be putting small amounts on just to play around with it, right?
Yeah, again, it's still early. These are solvable problems. One of the things we talked about in Adelaide was some simple things we can do that will make that way less common. And simple improvements in terms of how we do routing, these kinds of things that, again, are being worked on, can make this hopefully a non-issue.
Okay.
So I'm not too worried about it, but, you know, things are still early.
So one last question on Lightning, and then we'll look to wrap up. Tell me if this is true or not. The only thing I've heard about Lightning that I don't like, this is just literally one thing, is that you have to be online to receive a payment.
Yeah.
That, to me, is the one thing I'm like, that sucks.
Yeah, it does.
Is there any thoughts or plans around getting around that? Is there a future where you think you won't have to be online?
No.
No.
No, I mean, yeah, you'll need something online. Now, you can imagine a world where maybe when your device goes offline, you hand it off to a server, and a server maybe receives payments on your behalf temporarily until you're back online, and then it can forward them to you, you know, something like that. You can be a bit more creative with it.
Okay.
And play around with the trust model a little bit. You know, obviously that server now has some visibility into the things you're doing and also is trusted at least while you're offline. You know, you can play around with it a lot. But, you know, yeah, ultimately that is a trade-off of Lightning. And that is kind of one of the key trade-offs. And so there will always be use cases that Lightning won't make sense for. And that's fine. And that's important, right? Bitcoin, again, it's about, to me, filling niches where existing services don't work. And for Bitcoin to have maximal, like, adoption and, you know, Bitcoin to really be great, we have to fill all of the niches, and we have to have different systems for different use cases because people have different requirements.
So really, we should all get a custom node and be online all the time.
A lot of people are going to do that.
All right, so I've got two questions left. You might not even want to answer this one, but I'm starting to see a lot of discussions now around inflation, Bitcoin. Peter Todd brought it up in my interview, and he said, look, if you can't afford a 1% inflation, what are you doing with your life? Other people have started just to suggest that maybe in the future it might be a good thing for Bitcoin. Yet there's also a group of people who are like completely anti, and I completely understand their position, but to the point of almost humiliating anyone for suggesting it should even be talked about. Where do you stand on this?
I mean, we can have a conversation about it, but you know, ultimately, one of the key, I think one of, if not the key ingredient for Bitcoin to have success in the future is going to be that for changes to get made, you have consensus, right? So things like 2x dying and getting killed and all of the stuff we went through back then gave me a lot of confidence in Bitcoin, because we had users come out and say, no, this is bad, and it killed it in its tracks. And so many, and key to that is that people who got into Bitcoin with a certain view that was realistic of how Bitcoin works should be able to stay in Bitcoin, and that view shouldn't necessarily be changed unless they want it to. And a lot of people got into Bitcoin because there's this 21 million cap, and I don't think we'll ever, ever be in a world where there will be some level of consensus to remove it and have inflation.
Okay.
Even worse, I don't think inflation, like inflation just kicks the can down the road, right? You can either have some fixed percentage inflation, you could say 1% inflation forever. If you do that, then your block reward goes up exponentially, and eventually, you know, maybe after we're all dead, but eventually your block reward's going to be huge and you've just kicked the can down the road, like now your system is nonsense. Right. Or you could have fixed inflation, you could have fixed block reward forever, and percentage-wise, your inflation slowly goes down.
Like Grin.
Grin might have that.
Yeah, I think it has.
And percentage-wise, your inflation slowly goes down. So now, okay, eventually you're going to have these kinds of transaction fees, because you're going to have decreasing effective value of your block reward, and you've just kicked the can down the road. You haven't actually solved the problem of not needing to rely on these transaction fees. You've just, you know, maybe it'll be after your lifetime, so you don't care, but, you know, I'm interested in building a long-term Bitcoin, so.
Right, okay. This has been amazing. I've got one final question. What are you working on? What do you want to tell people about? What do you think people should care about? And then finally, how can people follow your work?
Yeah, so currently my projects are around, you know, I'm getting a little bit back into Bitcoin Core, doing more contribution there. But also we talked about BetterHash. That's been a key thing for me, trying to build excitement around it, trying to convince pools to go adopt it, trying to work with some pools to make sure the spec is good and up to snuff, up to par for them. Another one is Rust Lightning. So I have a Lightning library that I mentioned that's hopefully for, you know, if you have an existing wallet or you want to build a Lightning wallet, especially a non-custodial one, it handles most of the actual Lightning protocol for you, so that you can take, you know, whatever your existing chain sync is, and you can figure out how you want to integrate Lightning, whether it's syncing the current state, whether it's with watchtowers, you know, whatever model you want to have. Hopefully this Rust Lightning project enables people to do that. Finally, we're doing another residency at Chaincode. If you want to get into protocol development and you are a developer and maybe know some about Bitcoin and are excited by Bitcoin, but don't necessarily feel like you have a like complete grasp on the protocol, go to residency.chaincode.com and apply. It's a great program. We've had great success when we've done it in the past. People love it, have generally found jobs in the space afterwards. So definitely apply. Don't feel shy. But apply soon. We're doing rolling admissions. So the sooner you apply, the better a chance you have.
Brilliant. This has been amazing. Thank you for giving me some time to do this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what do you make of that? That's pretty interesting, right? I really enjoyed this interview, as there are thoughts I have which I know might not always be welcome, but with Matt, he was pretty cool with everything I asked, and we agreed on a number of things. For example, with Lightning UX, and don't get me wrong, I love Lightning, I'm really excited by it, but my experience so far hasn't been great. And listen, I know we're super early, which is fine. Equally, I think it's worthy discussion about the onboarding experience, because someone new to Bitcoin going all the way through to Lightning is facing a mammoth task. My experience with Blue Wallet was, yeah, it wasn't the best. I think it's cool, but it just wasn't the easiest to get from that point of having no wallet to having a funded Lightning wallet. But it was great to hear Matt's view on a variety of subjects, and I hope I'll get to interview him again. And like I said, if you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. And as I mentioned in my intro, and some of you might already know, I'm out in Tokyo to interview Mark Capellas, which is part of a series of interviews I've got due to be released next week about Mt. Gox. I've got interviews with Jeb McCalla, Brock Pierce, and a few others. So keep an eye out for those. They're going to be coming every day next week, so pretty busy. And listen, thank you to everyone who supports the show. Anything you do, doesn't matter whether you just listen, whether you share it, or if you've left me a review on iTunes, everything helps. But if you do want to support the show and you're new, you've never heard this before, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. Firstly, and I keep saying this, just listen to the ads. Listen to the ads is the most important thing you can do, because the advertisers pay for me to do this. So make sure you check those out. If you don't want to listen to the ads, you've become a patron. I've got 78 now, which is utterly amazing. It keeps growing every week. I am so grateful. But for $5 a month, you can get the podcast early and without ads. Just head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. And if you don't want to use Patreon, you can subscribe with crypto. Just drop me an email, I'll give you an address, and I'll add you to the distribution list. And you can also become a show sponsor. Downloads grow every month. We had a record month in January, over 121,000 downloads. Just email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. We can organize a call to discuss that. You can leave me a review on iTunes, or you can click on the subscribe button. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Medium, I'm at WhatBitcoinDid on everything. My personal Twitter is at Peter McCormack. DMs are open, just don't send me any nonsense. You can check out my website, which is WhatBitcoinDid.com, and you can sign up to my newsletter there. And you can also share the show out with your friends and family. As I said, next week is Mt. Gox week. I need to get to sleep. I'm absolutely shattered. I need to get up and do this interview with Mark tomorrow. So yes, I hope you enjoy the interview. If you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@WhatBitcoinDid.com.